Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you again for the drum. Last year I did this exact same day when everyone was at Dharma camp. I didn't get the drum coming in. I had it ready in my mind that I was ready to maybe, you know, hum it to myself, but it wasn't necessary. So today's talk about cooking. How do we work with what arises in the heart mind? This is my favorite question. And Zen has so many different answers. In Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Shunro Suzuki likens Zen practice to learning to bake dough into bread. Just to practice Zazen and put ourselves in the oven is our way. It sounds so uncomfortable. Why would we want to do this? I'm going to have a little disclaimer I sometimes use at the beginning of my talks. Along the spectrum of possibilities of Zen practice, with mindfulness at one end and mysticism at the other end, I favor the mystical strain of Zen practice. There is tremendous benefit to the mindfulness practices, so if that's what you're doing, keep at it. But I have a slightly different focus today. Instead of working with metaphors of letting go, which is more the mindfulness end, like dusting a mirror until it is clean and bright, I will look at metaphors of cooking or turning, which often ask us to step into resistance and discomfort. We step into this discomfort because, in the mystical view, the essence of a core hindrance sometimes contains something precious and has the potential to increase our capacity for joy and love. And if we can increase the quality and quantity of love in our lives, then it's worth a little discomfort. Sitting in meditation today, I had this line right from the end of my talk. It kept coming up. So I'm just going to read that, and then I'll go right back to the beginning. Let's see. It goes like this. In mystical Zen, the story of your life is not the story of the being you are supposed to be. It is the story of the being you're supposed to learn to love. That's where the cooking comes in. Okay. Some of you might have caught it. About a month or two ago, there was one of those tricycle talks, which I sometimes listen to. I listened to this one. It was William Waldron. He was talking on Yogacara Buddhism. And he used the metaphor, the Yogacara metaphor, of the mind as a stream with deep currents and a surface buffeted by winds. But also, deeper in the stream, there are latent tendencies or hindrances that are often dormant until they are triggered. The big problem with latent tendencies is that you can't always see them. That is, they do not always appear as thoughts. But it doesn't mean they are not there. Hidden away, they continue to act upon us. I understand latent tendencies as layered emotions. We've all seen layered emotions in movies. Actually, movies do this really well. You might have a couple at the restaurant, a man and a woman, and something happens at a neighboring table, and one of them will say, the man, he reacts completely over the top to what's going on. And then the movie cuts away to something that happened in childhood, something what happened in childhood that kind of explains the overreaction of the man. Okay. And then the movie continues. And then maybe later in the movie, a similar situation comes up, but the movie doesn't cut away. But in your mind, you're thinking, is he gonna do that again? Because you know there's something going on other than what's on surface there. Okay, so how to approach this problem of latent tendencies or hindrances or layered emotions. Story number one. This is a story that means a lot to me, but we'll see if it makes any sense to you. When I was young and poor and got a brand new job, I rented an attic apartment with a separate entrance in a very old house. All is well till I came home late on a moonless night. I stood in front of the door, but couldn't find a way to fit my key into the old-fashioned lock. It was an old door, an old house, an old lock. There was a light over the door, but it was very dim. I couldn't see what I needed to see. Finally, after an embarrassing amount of time, I got down onto my hands and knees and kind of felt the key into the lock. The next morning, in full daylight, I stopped at the doorway and looked at the bulb. It was 15 watts. And 15 watts was not enough for me to see. So here's the question. Can you see what you need to see in that space between thoughts in Zazen? How much can you see? And maybe with a little more light, we could see a little more. Whatever your starting point, what could you see if you add a little wattage? Second story. When my sister and I were very young children, she had a Betty Crocker Easy Bake Oven. Maybe you're familiar with these. I looked these up on eBay the other day, and they're worth a lot of money now, the originals. The early models used tiny light bulbs as a heat source, and the cooking power was limited to 350 degrees. Betty Crocker sold special cookie mixes that would bake well in the oven, but you couldn't put just anything in there. It wouldn't cook. Some things wouldn't cook. By contrast, a pizza oven heats up to about 650 degrees Fahrenheit, and a ceramic kiln to 1500 or 1600 degrees. So you see where I'm going here with this. If we follow Suzuki and think of Zen practice as baking raw dough in an oven until it is bread, then what is the temperature rating of our Zazen oven? Is it adequate to baking the bread? And even if we could find a way to generate more heat, is my Zazen container strong enough to hold that heat, or would it leak out? So in this mystical view of Zen, we are generating heat and light of life energy all the time. And the problem is that some of us act in ways that leak out this heat. The heat flows out. It leaks. It lessens our ability to bake bread. We need to find a way to minimize these leaks. How do we do this? We could start by trying to identify these outflows. And this is where the mystical model practice gets interesting, as it looks at the problem backward from luminosity. Imagine someone wandering about in luminosity, and someone asks them, "What's it like? Can you do whatever you want, or are there rules?" And this person wandering around in luminosity says, "Well, I notice if I start to get angry, then the light starts to dim and it gets a little cooler. Some of the luminosity seems to escape or stream out." You can see where I'm going here. From the perspective of luminosity, the Buddhist precepts are a list of leaks and outflows. But in reverse, these same outflows are portals to luminosity. Keeping the precepts, even on subtle levels, is the way we can increase our wattage or the temperature of our Zazen oven. Cooking and the three stages of keeping the precepts. At the end of my last talk, someone asked me a question about vows, and I was really uncomfortable with my answer. So I've been thinking about that question and my answer for 6 months. So I'm going to give it another try now. In the first stage of keeping the precepts are prohibitions. Do not steal. Do not get angry. This is the pushing away of flawed or negative energy. The first step then, for some of us, might need to be a fierce no. Fierce no, fierce hand movement. A hard no is then a crucial tool, and one we should always have in our toolbox. And this is part of the power of a formal vow. But the energy of a hard no is not present in the body and cannot be baked or turned. Or rather, if we do feel it in our body, it has a hardness to it. The energy has a hardness to it. There's like a refusal. The second stage of keeping the precepts might be a gentler no. Maybe some of our neural pathways have changed and we are more comfortable with our situation. On a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is a hard no, maybe this is a 6 or 7. A third stage involves softening even more and greater kindness. Maybe it can even include a bow, a gassho to what you first saw as negative energy. On a scale of 1 to 10, this might be a 3 to 5, and you feel the energy in the body. This is the stage of cooking or baking. This is, of course, an experiment we all need to do for ourselves and find out how that feels and where it works and where it doesn't. Not too close, not too far away. Always exceptions, but on a scale between 1 and 10, maybe 3 to 5. Very much present, but far enough away to allow the possibility of a loving bow. At this point, you are both the force of the flawed energy and the bowing being holding the flawed energy. That's the crucial part. This is where the cooking and baking takes place. It's a moment of tension. Whether the heat and light metaphors work for you or not, the point of the talk is to get to this exact point. You are both the flawed energy and the loving, bowing being holding the energy. We can all think bowing, but what does it mean to embody this feeling in your Zazen? We can all think loving, but what does it mean to embody loving in your Zazen? Whenever I come to something like this, I think of when I was 11 years old, I had this friend, Victor. Victor said he could do two things. He could take a watch apart, put it back together with only six things left over. And if he concentrated really hard, he could make smelly stuff come out of his ears. It reminds me when I'm with a physical therapist and say, well, wiggle the middle finger on your right foot. You know, it's really clumsy. But it's like that. I think at this point in Zazen, it's like we want to love more, we want to bow, but what does it mean inside? What does it mean inside? Finding out how to sound just the right note or tune yourself to just the right frequency. There is a way to work towards accepting and breathing in both our own flaws and the flaws of others. And understanding that this process of accepting temporary discomfort increases our capacity for love. I'll just in closing say a little bit more about working the gaps. Working the gap between stimulus and response. So there is a gap between word and deed. You can say something without doing it. You can work backwards on that. There's a gap between thought and word. You can say something without saying it. So even though the thought is present, you don't need to take it further. So you can back up there. And there's a gap between stimulus and thought. between natural thought and deliberate thought. Just because a thought arises doesn't mean you have, this is Gio Kennett here, just because a thought arises doesn't mean you have to invite it in for tea. Make in the short term, we don't have any control over our immediate response to a stimulus. But over a long term, we do. By continually working backwards in that gap, we can change our response. This brings me to the end of my talk, which was also my beginning, one more time. In mystical Zen, the story of your life is not the story of the being you are supposed to be. It is the story of the being you're supposed to learn to love. So we're born with those tendencies within us, and they're given to us to work to help us learn how to love. That's it for today. Thank you.
If you're in the room and you have a question, please raise your hand. I'll bring you the microphone. Please state your name and hold the microphone up to your mouth while you speak. If you're on Zoom and you have a question, you can type your name in the chat and Tony will unmute you so you can ask your question, or you can type your question in the chat and Tony will read it for you.
Thank you for your talk. Amy here. Can you talk a little bit more about that stimulus response, working it backwards, and how that gets you to maybe move more slowly in real time?
Well, it comes right out of the Buddhist verse for contrition or repentance, that something like goes like this: all the evil committed by me is committed by my body, speech, and mind. I now confess all wholeheartedly. And it's just working backwards in the flow of the way that energy moves through us in our activities. And in a rather outrageous example, Thich Nhat Hanh says in one of his books, going to visit a prostitute is a preferable choice if the other option is killing someone. It's like wherever we are on the spectrum of activities that we're working with, we can always take it back one notch.
Thank you, that helps.
Jiko here. You talked about these three relationships to the precepts, and I think it's easy for us to assume that when we're done with number one, we move on to number two and number three, and then we don't ever have to go back to that beginning stage, but I have found that that's not true. We do sometimes have to start all over with do not. It's so easy to get complacent in that luminosity, taking it for granted.
So. Thank you. Yeah, I think I think some of you have had a hard time in your life setting boundaries with people, then at the beginning, you start with a hard no. Yeah.
Thank you for your talk. I'm Guy. I was reminded by a number of things you said, of a statement that I heard from a philosopher in discussion with a couple other philosophers, something to the effect that there's a property in music called tone, which everybody's heard of, and tone arises from tension. And we, you know, literally tension between opposing poles, right? You pull a string and there's a tension there. And, but we have a kind of, there's a pejorative, or there's a negative connotation with the word tension, right? tension connotes something, some kind of contradiction, source of stress, but there's a need for that tension if you want to produce a tone.
Mm.
And so, you know, a number of things that you said kind of reminded me of that. The, as you say, the distance of separation between a thought and a word and so on, there's also sort of a tension there, right? And it seems like if we pay attention to that tension, the tones can arise from it that are not necessarily unpleasant.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm reminded during my years at Shasta Abbey of two things. One, when I was a novice monk, and the disciplinarian asked to see all the novices, and we all gathered around. It was a lot of monks then. There's like 15 or 16 of us. And he said, "You're all afraid of making a mistake." And I thought, that was why I was here, was not to make mistakes. And I didn't understand it at all at the time. And a couple of years later, I heard one of the Roshis say, especially a monastic practice was a wonderful vehicle for cultivating the will. But he said it was possible to use the will to blast the koan right out of the body. And that was not Zen practice. I guess that's what I'm trying to get into here is that place where we can turn or cook that energy. Hugh Kennett used to talk about some of these core hindrances as confused or saddened love. You know, it needs to be tweaked or turned or baked or cooked.
Hi, this is Genko. I found a lot to think about in your talk. One of the ones was this business about no. I sometimes think about the power of no, take the W off of that title. In fact, a couple of us were just talking during the break about how one of the things we learn as we age is how to say no. And I don't think that that's a pretty hard no, but at some point the body just says, we're not doing that, right? So, I thought about that years ago. I started realizing that if somebody said, "Would you do this?" and "Are you interested in doing this?" all I could feel was tired. That probably the answer needed to be no.
Mm.
Also, I had a situation where something. I think it was. I went to Kyogen. This was at a retreat. I went to Kyogen in Sanzen, and I'd had a dream. And I told him about the dream. He said, "Oh, well, do you think there's anything like this in the dream?" And I said, "Huh, I hadn't even thought about that." I went back to the cushion and I was furious. So when I went back to Sanzen with him, I said, "You know what? I really got furious." Now, one of the things I think about that is that I noticed that I was furious. It wasn't like I was just furious. There was part of me going, "Well, that's interesting. What's going on?"
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of this can come from, this understanding about the backing up, is that what came up for me in those moments was, "No, I don't want, no, no, no." And I thought, that's really strange. So I took that back to Kyogen. He said, and he listened to me for a while. He said, "Well, sometimes you have to say yes to no." Which I've always loved that. There are things that when that really strong no comes up, that hard no, you just have to go, "Oh, okay." That's where we're at.
Right.
No. And there's something really good about that, really positive about that. So the prohibitions and the precepts look like they're negative and prohibitions, but the fact is there's something very powerful about a good hard no.
Right. Times.
So
thank you.
Hi, this is Jekinen. Thanks for the talk. Feels really, really pertinent right now, actually. I don't know, for some reason, working on some stuff. So I was, the metaphor and the scale that you gave from 1 to 10, and the hard no being like a 10, and the 3 to 5 being like holding both parts of us in ourselves in compassion. I was hoping there was a 1 to 3, but maybe there isn't.